Hello, everyone. This is Dr. Erin Stair, and we're back. It's another episode of Causes or Cures. I hope you guys are doing okay. We are still in the throes of COVID-19, and man, it is tough. And it's only going to get tougher as the holiday season approaches and the cold sets in, at least here in the United States. And then we're going to have to deal with the COVID blues and the holiday blues. So, you know, it is imperative that you check on your neighbors. Check in, especially people who live alone, because it can be a really an extra tough time for them. Today, I'm going to talk about something that has gotten worse during the pandemic. Of course, a lot of things have gotten worse, but this is another epidemic, and it's an epidemic that we talked about a lot before COVID-19 took the spotlight. Of course, that epidemic is the opioid epidemic, and man, it has gotten a lot worse. There's a lot more overdose deaths. There's a lot of people struggling, a lot more people struggling. And of course, it might make sense because people are alone more. People are isolated. People can't do a lot of the things that they want to do. It sort of sets the perfect storm for relapsing. I have to tell you, I grew up in a small town in Pennsylvania, and man, oh man, the opioid epidemic ran through that town. And you saw the effects from the top down. I went to a small high school, and even there, I know 5 or 6 people who died from overdosing on opioids. Even the systemic effects, you know, somebody died and has a little kid left behind. And then all of a sudden, that kid's grandparents, who wanted to retire, have to go back to work and try to support this kid, try to give this kid some kind of life. It's terrible. I also recently read an article, it's very well written in The New Yorker, and it talked about the Purdue Pharma and the Sackler family. And wow. The corruption from the top down in terms of hiding data, manipulating data. And doctors were involved in this. Doctors who take an oath to first do no harm. And incorrect, inaccurate information was relayed to the drug representatives. And they were telling doctors one story, a story that just wasn't correct. And a story that led to the opioid epidemic and a lot of people getting addicted. Of course, they are involved in all sorts of lawsuits, as they should be. But man, oh man, and they tell you to trust the drug companies and trust the research that they put out. And they're in it for, they're not in it for the profit. But anyways, I'm going to share that article with you. I'll post it in the blog description. But today I'm super excited to have on the line somebody who is an expert on opioids and addiction. That is Dr. John Kelly. Dr. Kelly is a professor of psychiatry and addiction medicine at Harvard Medical School. He is founder and director of the Recovery Research Institute at the Massachusetts General Hospital. I can never say that state. He's the associate director of the Center for Addiction Medicine and the program director of the Addiction Recovery Management Service. He's also the former president of the American Psychological Association Society of Addiction Psychology, and he's a consultant to many federal agencies, as well as publishing or authoring over 200 peer-reviewed articles. So he knows his stuff, guys. And he's going to talk about what is happening right now with the opioid epidemic, the changes in treatment, how stress and being alone impacts people who are struggling with addiction more than somebody who's not. He's going to talk about when is the time that you most have to worry about relapse, and what the future should look like in terms of getting many people as well as possible on the road to recovery. Okay, guys, so let's just tune into Dr. Kelly and hear what he has to say. Thanks. Okay, perfect.
I haven't used Skype for ages. Now, of course, Zoom's taken over, hasn't it?
No, it really has. I've always liked Skype, and I know everybody else uses Zoom, and I'm still like, I don't know, like Amish or something.
Well, it was interesting that you suggested Skype. I'm thinking, wow.
I think I can still remember
how to use that.
I'm old fashioned, and I got a kick. I got a kick out of your Skype name, anyways. anyways, thanks so much for doing this. I know it's early, but yeah. This is a public health podcast, and obviously this is a huge public health issue. Yeah. So just to start, because not everybody knows who you are, can you just give a brief description of what you do?
Yeah, sure. I'm a professor of addiction medicine and psychiatry at Harvard Medical School. I'm a director of a research institute called the Recovery Research Institute at Massachusetts General Hospital and Harvard Medical School. And I'm a clinician, clinical psychologist by training, but I do a lot of, most of my time is spent in doing research on treatment and recovery support services and how to understand how people achieve and sustain long-term remission.
Okay, that was great. I wanted to focus this conversation obviously around the pandemic, the COVID-19 pandemic, and what is going on. You know, we used to hear about the opioid epidemic. It was the epidemic, right? We heard about it all the time, and now we don't hear about it as much. Mm. Obviously you do, but like we aren't hearing about it in the news cycle as much.
Yeah, right.
So I guess to start off, in your opinion, how has COVID-19 impacted what's going on with the opioid epidemic?
Well, as you mentioned, Erin, you know, what it's done is pushed it into the background in terms of the media cycle and the news, because COVID is taking headlines 24/7, of course. But it doesn't mean that it's gone away. So this is the kind of false perception. Just because it's not in the headline news every day the way it was, it does not mean it's gone away. In fact, it's increased. We've seen an increase this year over last year of somewhere in the range of anywhere from, you know, when this thing started back in February, March, going up through April, May, it's gone up about 20, 30, 40% over last year in terms of overdose deaths.
Wow. And has the demographics changed at all? Is it similar, just sort of getting worse in the same populations?
Well, we're seeing those who of low SES, and particularly minorities, have gone up. African Americans and Hispanics have gone up relative to whites in this past year.
Mm-hmm. And they're getting hit the hardest by COVID too.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And alcohol use has gone up too.
Yes.
Right? Is that okay? So, and the thing around overdoses, probably, you know, people are alone more. So is that, I would imagine that makes it harder to kind of, in terms of getting to somebody who might have overdosed. That's the other thing. I wanted to ask you a little bit about, obviously, during the pandemic, COVID-19 pandemic, everybody's really stressed out. So can you talk a little bit about how stress impacts someone trying to recover from from opioid use?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, we know stress is a major precursor to relapse for people who are trying to get and stay in recovery from an opioid problem, opioid use disorder, or other substance use disorder. There are kind of three major pathways through which relapse risk is increased. One is through cue reactivity, that's to say, you know, the triggers associated with drug use, people, places, and things, drug cues that can increase craving, and through that classical conditioning pathway can increase the risk of relapse. But stress is a major second pathway. And this is both positive stresses and negative stresses. But the kinds of stresses that we're seeing now are negative stresses. So these are stress due to isolation, due to lack of contact with social supports and other healthcare professionals that can provide help for individuals and support. That social isolation, of course, we know has a physiological effect in the body. in healthy humans. So it's not good for humans to be isolated, and it's even worse, it's amplified for people who have prior drug use disorders who are trying to recover, in part because there's lots of changes, biochemical changes that go on as a function of drug exposure, which mean that they're at heightened sensitivity for stress. So we're all stressed out right now through the social isolation and the fear and worry associated with directly the virus, of course, but all the other things associated with the virus and what that means for us all. But for people who are trying to get and stay in recovery, it's a much more amplified effect. So they're going to be experiencing much more higher levels of stress.
And when you say that they're hypersensitive to stress, is that something that gets better as the recovery process moves along?
Yeah. There are two things that happen when people are addicted. One is that there is a decreased sensitivity to reward and an increased sensitivity to stress. And this is just part of the, kind of post-acute withdrawal phenomena that go on when people stop using a substance, is that there is this increase in kind of a rebound effect of stress sensitivity as the central nervous system begins to recalibrate, readjust, readapt to life without the drugs. And on the other side, the reward sensitivity has been because of this very high regular exposure to these abnormally high levels of reward and reinforcement by way of a drug. So the brain has adapted to these abnormally high levels of reward and reinforcement, and the brain has to readjust and readapt to normal levels of reward in the brain through the dopamine pathway in the brain. So those two pathways of stress and reward mean that it's incredibly difficult early on for people to remain in recovery, because those two systems mean that people are stressed out and they don't experience normal levels of reward, the kinds of just normal levels of reward that we would get from a sunny day, from reading a good book, watching a good movie, being with friends. That is dampened, it's downregulated. So people have a very hard time early on. This is why people need so much support early, in the early weeks and months before that regulation, that upregulation and downregulation of the stress pathways begin to take effect. And of course, as I mentioned, when you're isolated and cut off from people, that makes it much harder.
Just a formula for not. And out of curiosity, in your opinion, how long is there an average time, if somebody is in recovery where they might start to normalize that stress response or their ability to respond to rewards normally?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, we don't know for sure. Generally, what we see is a gradual improvement. You see a rapid improvement in the first 2 to 3 months. A more gradual improvement thereafter, and then a bigger improvement after about 12 months, 12 to 18 months.
Okay. That's good, because I think knowing those times can give somebody hope.
Yes.
Yeah.
We did a national recovery study where we looked at, a representative sample of the U.S. population of people in recovery. This was about 2,000 individuals who had resolved a significant drug or alcohol problem. And interestingly, what we saw there was that there was this initial benefit in the first few weeks, kind of in that first initial phase. And what was interesting was that their happiness, self-esteem, these are not biological factors, but psychological factors, they actually dipped. Their sense of well-being and dropped after about 6 to 12 weeks of stability. It dropped significantly before rising again after about 12 months. And I thought that was very interesting why that was. And I just surmised that it may be that after that initial period of stabilization, where people do get a lot of support typically in that first month to 3 months, when there's a lot of, maybe family support, friends, healthcare providers, et cetera. And once the person is stable, They may, with the intensity of that support may be withdrawn, and also the person themselves begin as the fog starts to clear in their own brain, and they start to see things more clearly and perhaps reflect a little bit more. Sometimes it can be a daunting prospect looking forwards at what needs to be done to catch up for some people, and also looking backwards when they see about, you know, kind of the wreckage of the past, and they say, well, how am I going to clear up all this mess and, you know, kind of get back on track? And that can be, I think, in that once that kind of quote unquote pink cloud stage wears off, that initial phase of stability wears off, there can be a period in that second half of the first year where people begin to perhaps feel the real daunting, you know, feel more daunted about the prospects of what's to come. And that's where I think we're a bit remiss, I think, in terms of understanding that phenomenon and helping people to maintain, because it looks like after that first year, things start to go up steadily. But it's that second half of the first year, perhaps, that we've tended to neglect in terms of providing also very strong support, helping people to reflect and to reframe what's happened, and to hopefully instill hope that things will get better. Just if they hang in there, it's going to pass, and they will be able to get better, and things will start to look rosier and feel rosier going forwards.
That's really interesting. I've never heard that before. Mm. Even it sounds like too, maybe there's room for obviously you'd have to do a study, but you know, it's kind of like cost effective interventions where you don't have, that you might need support, but it doesn't necessarily have to come from, you know, a healthcare provider or a therapist who may have to, tend to more severe cases or something like that. Mm-hmm. So that my next question is, given all of this and, you know, the isolation, how have treatment approaches changed during the COVID-19 pandemic?
Yeah, well, there's been a number of different changes that have occurred, both in terms of medication and also psychosocial supports and telemedicine, and telepsychiatry. So there's been a huge change, of course, in terms of medication provision. So there's been the kind of more regimented and stricter controls over, when people can get their medication and where. Those have been loosened so that people can have take-home doses for weeks, if not a month at a time. So this has meant that it reduces exposure to people who are addicted, so they can still get access to the medication but remain at low risk for contracting COVID. And that's been extremely helpful. Also, there's been this massive, of course, transition to telemedicine, to using online virtual formats for communication via Zoom and the like. So that's been incredibly positive and eye-opening. I think we've all realized, as a function of being forced into this position, of course, through COVID, we've all realized just the value of doing telemedicine, telepsychiatry, counseling via things like Zoom, because people show up more. Interestingly, just the barriers of transport, parking, all the time that takes. We're finding both in our clinical work and in our research that no shows are down dramatically. So people are showing up to appointments more. Our research follow-up studies have increased in our follow-up quite substantially by about 10 to 15%. So all kinds of positive things have come out of this that we didn't expect in terms of just access to care. And these virtual online formats here that we can all use now is actually pretty good. Also in terms of mutual help groups, AA, NA, Smart Recovery, all of these mutual aid organizations that can provide very strong support for people in the community have also all moved online. So all those are accessible, easily accessible, pretty much 24/7 anywhere in the world. So this kind of opens up, doesn't it? You're not restricted anymore to your local community, but rather can access these resources globally.
That's interesting. And I know you know, it's just from like sort of a reducing stigma type of thing too. Maybe more people show up. I know just from my experience in the military, no one really wanted to go if they needed any kind of help in person, mm-hmm. but mm-hmm. they might have been more inclined, you know, until we get, we reduce stigma overall, which is another yeah. challenge.
Yeah. 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 I mean, that's one positive thing too, is the access. Yes. For people, you know, of course with the mutual help groups, you don't have to put your camera on or even use your real name. So that makes it easier. I think one of the challenges, however, having said that, the positives, I think some of the negatives are that it's more difficult for people who are trying to get a foothold in recovery to get a foothold because of the lack of in-person. I think initially that in-person exposure and connection can be very helpful for folks. To develop relationships, it's harder to do that via these telemedicine approaches, although not impossible. It does work, but it's just more difficult.
That makes sense. I think there is a value to in-person connections, and maybe it's a segment too. If you do more studies on it, you'll find like an ideal population for online versus, you know, people who do better in person. Mm-hmm. I just wanted to ask you a question just because it's something lit up in my mind. In terms of like an abstinence approach versus, I guess, like maybe like a stepped level where you kind of choose your own, like, I'm going to try to reduce by 25%, not necessarily for opioids, but any kind of substance. Do you have any opinion on that, what you think is more effective?
Well, it's different pathways for different folks. That's the way to think about it, is that some people don't want to stop immediately, and so they prefer a stepped approach to reducing their use. And we work with people like that all the time who stay in treatment, but we kind of meet them where they're at, help them navigate that course in terms of reducing substance use. And that can be very successful for some people. For other people, they need to stop immediately and they want to stop. And so given the risk level some people are using at, it can be helpful to help them to stop. And for those people, an abstinent approach is the best. So it's different courses for different horses, as they say.
Okay. And I would imagine having a reliable, I grew up in like a rural Pennsylvania, and we didn't always have like a reliable internet connection. So I would imagine that's part of this too. Telemedicine is a little different than digital apps, and that's another way where I see a lot of approaches going. I actually worked a little bit on that, not for opioids, but what are your feelings on apps versus, and now you're not having a person there to guide you or a support group, but just someone works through an app by themselves.
Yeah, well, they're very popular apps because they're fairly easy to do. They can have a wide distribution, of course, globally, instantly once they're made and constructed and put out there. The problem with apps is, like anything else, people drop off very, very quickly. So they might download the app, they might register, they might do something on the app for a day or two, but within a week, they've dropped way down. So it's the staying with it is the problem. Now, not to say some people, but it's a tiny minority of people actually will stay with an app by themselves. Typically, people will drop off. Now, there have been successes, though, using mobile technology on a smartphone with clinical support. So that's a little different. Okay. It's kind of using an app, as it were, but with clinical engagement and support that can help remotivate that person to re-engage, utilize the app in concert with a clinician. And that's been shown to be effective when that's done. But not the apps alone, it's just very hard to get people to stick with it. People just drop off. Yeah.
And I would imagine, I don't know, you would know this, if there's more of an effort to make the apps regulated somehow or standardized. Because I feel like anybody can submit an app to the app store.
Yes.
Right. And if it looks really cool, you might do it, but it might not be written by anybody who has any idea what they're doing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right. Exactly. Yes. So, yeah, there's lots of popular apps that look good and, you know, for all kinds of addictive behaviors, and most notably smoking, cigarette smoking. But the there's hundreds and hundreds and hundreds of them. And yes, you don't know what kind of quality, whether they're based on evidence-based principles or practices or not. So, you know, actually one of my colleagues, Bettina Hoppner, did a review of, I think, alcohol apps and tobacco apps. And the vast majority were not based on any kind of evidence base at all.
Do you think that they should be tested in a randomized controlled trial? I mean, some people say, oh, we follow a protocol that has been tested. But do you think the app itself should be tested?
Yes, absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes. And that's a kind of an easy get out in my book is to say, well, the basis, but you know, our stuff is based on evidence-based practices or principles. You really need to test it out properly to make sure that people know what it is, how effective it is, especially if they're buying it, that it doesn't do any harm, that there are no side effects, even for an app, you know, that it doesn't cause undue stress or lead people down the wrong path. And it's very important, regardless of if something is based on evidence-based principles or practices, that you still need to test it out in the real world to prove that it works as well, at least as well as something else that somebody could do, or better. Of course, that would be the ideal.
Yeah, I'm with you on that. I don't see a lot of. I think there might be more of a push towards that. But how they will regulate it, I don't know yet.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I have two final questions. Well, maybe it's more like one question, I guess. But I guess like going forward, from a public health perspective, what do you think is the best approach to the opioid epidemic? Whether that's on a community level, what sort of federal response that might involve, and you know, especially now, I have no idea how long, you know, this pandemic, the COVID-19 stuff is going to go on. Nobody really does.
Yes.
But what do you think is the best public health approach now?
Well, I think we need to keep our foot on the gas in terms of improving the public health infrastructure to access to evidence-based medications for opioid use disorder, that is to say buprenorphine, methadone, and naloxone, naltrexone, for overdose prevention, i.e. Narcan, that people can have easy access to that and make sure that that is available for people on demand, including treatment on demand, so that people can access that. But we know that medications can reduce the risk of overdose death by 50%. So having access to that is very important. Having access to other kinds of psychosocial case management services that can help people beyond kind of metabolic stabilization so that they can reduce cravings with the help of the medications, but then also attend to the other aspects of their life that they need to attend to in terms of getting back on track. And there are a number of emerging and growing recovery support services in addition to clinical services around the United States. For example, recovery community centers are centers which provide access to recovery resources, jobs, housing, other social services for young moms, et cetera, so that they can get back on track and get connected with the kinds of resources that they need to build what we call recovery capital. And recovery capital, you can think of as kind of the resources needed to be able to get back on track and decrease that stress we talked about earlier. So recovery coaching, is another aspect which are embedded in recovery community centers, but they are also attached to many different clinical institutions now. For example, at Mass General Hospital where I work, we have about 20 recovery coaches who are embedded in our clinical care system, which provide instant rapport because these are people with lived experience. And they can help people get connected to the kinds of resources that can help them in the communities in which they live and are returning to after the hospital stay. So there are a number of things that we can do to increase the availability and repertoire of different resources that can support people in recovery. So because we, you know, it's not just about metabolic stabilization and reducing craving. We need to attend to the other kinds of factors that people need to get in their life, kind of the social determinants of health and recovery. And these things have been neglected historically, but are starting to be propagated now. And we've done research in these areas, and it's nice to see these things growing. Where I live now in Massachusetts here, we have 26 recovery community centers, all sponsored and funded by our state Department of Public Health.
Wow.
So these things are growing. Yeah.
Can I just ask you a question about marijuana? I mean, I'm sure you've heard of pain refugees, where they go to different states to where they can easily access marijuana. And there's been some studies that suggest if you have easier access to that might cut down on opioid use. What do you think of that?
Yeah, I think the jury's still out on that, whether that's a safe and effective way of mitigating pain and addressing pain. For some people, no doubt it is. The question is, we don't have strong evidence right now to suggest that we could prescribe or recommend cannabis products to mitigate pain universally, another kind of approach. So we need, you know, more studies desperately to understand that more.
Okay, yeah, that makes sense. And I guess my last question is, where do you think we're do you think it's going to get worse before it gets better? In terms of, because the opioid epidemic has kind of taken a backseat to COVID-19, do you think we're going to, the progress that we've made is, I don't know, not going to be there at the end once we get COVID-19 under control? Is this going to be like really bad, or do you have
I think
any?
It depends on the nature of, I think in part, the federal and state level, the focus and sensitivity to this issue. You know, I think we've seen some definite advances in terms of public health infrastructure under the current administration. I think there is a proposal underway, has been published already by the Biden administration, depending on who gets in November. We'll see that amps up substantially the investment in public health infrastructure for the opioid crisis and other alcohol and other drugs. So I think it will depend on what happens next in terms of the administration, whether it's going to stay the same or change. That will in part determine how much investment is made to address this epidemic and then the more endemic problem to alcohol and other drugs. And if the administration remains the same, then I think there's going to need to be, a continued foot on the gas once COVID hopefully mitigates, goes away. Hopefully next year, or better able to deal with it next year through vaccines or other things, better testing and so on, that we'll be able to reestablish and reassert the kinds of things that have been working. Some of those which I've outlined, which is the medication access, stigma is a big problem. And it's making sure that we can continue to help understand from the public standpoint and politician standpoint that these things are psychiatric disorders and that they need people need treatment and they need recovery support services, not punishment and not punitive rhetoric associated with that.
Right. And that goes back also to how people talk about it, and constantly educating people.
Yes.
Dr. Kelly, thank you so much for your time. I know it's Friday morning. I appreciate it. And I hope you enjoyed, your travel back in time to Skype. So anyways,
no, it works well. You've reminded me how well this works. Yeah.
I know, right? It's like, yeah. Sometimes it's the old car and it's still going. Why trade it in for a new one? Anyways, thank you so much. And enjoy the rest of your weekend there.
You too, Aaron. Yeah, pleasure talking with you.
Yes, likewise. Okay, yeah. Bye-bye.
All right, take care now. Bye-bye.
All right, guys, thank you so much for listening. I hope you subscribe. Please do. Please share this. And please check out some of the other episodes that are available on Causes or Cures. That said, if you have any feedback for me, any suggestions for topics or guests, please write me. My email is erin@bloomingwellness.com. You can contact me directly through my website too, bloomingwellness.com. And while you're there, you can check out the blog, the Zen Tones, the Zen Bands, all that stuff. In addition, I'm going to ask you guys a favor, which I don't do that often. I have written two books. One is called Manic Kingdom. The other is called Yours in Wellness, Crystal Healing, Letters from the Wellness Industry. Manic Kingdom is based on a true story. It's a very provocative true story. The main character is based on me, but it's not a memoir. It's definitely not a memoir. A lot of people say it reads more like a novel, but it's a story about embracing uncertainty and questioning systems, questioning where a lot of our facts come from. And in terms of embracing uncertainty, which I think is something that might be really helpful right now during this pandemic, because I see a lot of people struggling with that. It's about not having to have an answer for, you know, why this happened. The main character of Manic Kingdom, who is based on me, has a lot of problems. And she breaks down, and she bounces back. And it's definitely an unconventional bounce back, involving the help of a mysterious man that she met on a beach in California. But the whole, and a lot of people get really uncomfortable when they read it, because they're looking for answers. And they're like, I don't understand this. This doesn't help me. This doesn't help me solve my problems. And the point is really that, well, the answer is that she becomes comfortable with not having to have all of the answers, not having to have exact specific reasons for why she broke down. And that really is her journey to recovery. Anyways, I hope you read Manic Kingdom. And if you did read it, if you could leave a review on Amazon or Goodreads, I would be so grateful. I'd be so appreciative, because reviews are so important to indie authors. And then the other book is much more satirical. It's a parody on the business of wellness as much as it's a parody on Big Pharma. It's a series of 13 letters written from the perspective of Crystal Healing, who is CEO of a wellness company, a fictitious wellness company. And it takes on some of the absurdities I see in the business of wellness, but it explains them because of the absurdities that go on in Big Pharma. But it's a satire. Some people get offended by it, but you know, whatever. I hope you read it. And there's drawings in there too. I'm not going for any art awards. The drawings are sort of a spoof off of color therapy, if you will. Anyways, just check it out. It's available as an audiobook too. And if you read it and can leave a review, mwah, thank you. Thank you so much. It's helpful. All right, guys, I have got to go get ready and take my dog out for his morning stroll. Take care, guys. Bye.